center that does fantastic internet research just did a big study on millennials. And also conveniently for me, their website is really great. It makes it easy to pull out these different chunks. So I'm going to show you some of these chunks. And according to them, these names, these generations get nicknames, right? And so the Gen X, before we were called Gen X, were actually called the baby bust because we were the thing after the baby boom. I'm just telling you that to tell you to don't get too attached to the name millennials. It might change. I don't know. But this, you can't, maybe you can't tell, but this gal is in a phone booth in England. So that's the contrast with the phone, the pay phone. So this is according to the Pew study. Millennials are, in the U.S., are more ethnically diverse than the average population or than the people before them. They're less religious in general. They're less likely to serve in the military, and they're going to be. They're not yet, but at the rates they're entering school right now, especially because of high unemployment, they're going to be one of the most educated generations in history. Okay? So those are some interesting things to know about these folks. Notice everybody has cell phones. There's a story behind that picture, which I'm not going to explain because it won't make my point anyway. So who's online? First of all, it's not just the millennials, right? There's the teens and the young adults, but adults from 30 up to 64 and even 65 plus, almost 40% are online. So you should never think of the internet as just a way to talk to young people, for sure. However, you might customize different communications in different places. And again, we see in the top right, young people are more interested in social networking sites, but they're not the only ones. And I was pretty impressed to see 20% or 19% of adults use Twitter or something like it to do some kind of status update-y kind of thing. Who knows which thing it is. I think a lot of people use Facebook in the same way because you can do the status updates, right? Also notable that twice as many 18 to 24s are using Twitter or something like it as everybody else. And this is one of the things, again, that reminds us not to get stuck with any particular platform. Right now, of the people who have game consoles, right, which is like an Xbox or a PlayStation, almost a quarter of them use them to go online. And a portable gaming device is like a PS3, and of course cell phones and things like that. And with Twitter more and more, with smartphones, the iPhone is not the only smartphone, but it has really... it's really gotten people to see the point of smartphones. Me being a geek, always wanted something like that. Before we had the term smartphone, I kept saying, I want something that has my Palm Pilot with my addresses in it to be the same thing as my phone, instead of them being two different things in my calendar and all this stuff. So finally, those devices converged, and there are lots of other smartphones. There were ones before the iPhone, and there'll be ones after the iPhone. I'm not an iPhone fan. But I'm really happy that they have reached the level of penetration that people understand now what smartphones are and what they're for, that kind of thing. So this is a picture of another millennial here with his phone, of course. Are you reaching people in all these different places? Do you have something, if someone's on their Xbox and they're interested in what you're doing, are they going to find anything there in that community? What about in the PlayStation Network or Wii? Do you have some content that they can find there? Is there something relevant? But at the same time, again, don't get too attached to the platform, right? So if we're thinking about, like, what's the next device? What's the thing in the future? We all have to get on Xboxes now, right? Don't do that. I did a search for it. I wanted to find a flying car because that's what everyone thought the future was going to be. So, and everyone keeps saying now, okay, it's the millennium. Where are our flying cars? Hello. So about that next big thing, who knows what it is, right? And again, don't get too attached to a particular platform. But think about how are you going to be open. This is like one of the places where Twitter really rocks is that you can take it to all these different platforms. Which actually goes to open standards, something that I'm really interested in, something very geeky. But the more you make your data open and accessible, the easier it is for people to suck it in to all those different places. This is one of the reasons that blogs are great, and that even if you're not blogging, you should use a blog platform, because blogs automatically make a feed. It's called RSS feed, and it's a very standardized feed. So then if that's putting it out, then on literally on your PlayStation box, there's probably an RSS reader. Hopefully there's something more fun than that, too. If you use iGoogle and you have these different widgets or any of those kind of desktop widget systems, you can pull in RSS feeds. So you should always be using a blog platform because it makes it easy for you to put an RSS feed out there. And always be thinking about how people might use the content and how can you make it easy for people to use it. Okay, so there are some predictions. This is from a project, an ongoing project that's done by Pew and Elon University, which is a school in North Carolina. And they have a lot of really fun stuff on that website, too. Check that out. Oh, that's not the whole address of it. It's gotten cut off. I'll fix it for tomorrow. But one of the most important things, I'm maybe getting broken record-y now, is this 80% of experts think the hot whatevers are not currently evident. The point is, again, we don't know what the next big thing is. This is a study where they asked these people that they identified as experts. So you do want to take that with a little grain of salt. And there were several other predictions, but I thought these were interesting and you might be interested in as communicators, that Google won't make us stupid. You know, and everyone can think of examples where people are maybe Googling instead of doing something maybe the right way, or they're being lazy, just Googling things instead of doing more sophisticated research or things like that. But most of their experts felt that the flip side of that is that Google's also, I think it's silly, we're using Google in this sense, sort of in the way that in North Carolina people say Pepsi when they actually mean like a soda. Right? They say, do you want a Pepsi? So think of Google in that way. So not just Google, but the Internet. It also is opening us up to so much more information. And that's an opportunity for us to learn more. A lot of it depends on how we use it, right? And also the question of, you know, is reading going by the wayside? maybe reading things on paper will, but it doesn't mean that reading and knowledge are necessarily going to go away. Which brings me back to my sort of writing on the wall, where publishers have been confronted by the Internet for the last 10 or 15 years. I don't just mean you. You know, I frequently rant about the mainstream media and newspapers, things like that, and have not been evolving. And if that's the case, and that's what we're seeing now, right, in journalism, that so many newspapers are dying. It's really sad because they provide such an important function. I don't want them to go away. However, if they're not able to be relevant to people, then I can't make the case for why they should still exist, right? So they're becoming dinosaurs, and they need to evolve, right? Or else they're going to pass away. Maybe dinosaurs not a good enough. Right? Analogy. But like I said, we have some things to learn. So anyway, the future, who knows? But this was since they asked the people about 2020. That's a big bet. There are many more of those predictions if you're interested. So how do we prepare for the future? I recommend thinking about networks. The Internet is, of course, a network of networks, so it lends itself to that. But networks don't just mean the Internet, which is what I'll talk about tons tomorrow. I don't want to talk about too much today. That's a real graffiti. I didn't, like, make that or anything. Sorry, it's a little bit illegible. So if we're thinking about networks and social networks, the news is, again, networks weren't created online, and MySpace didn't invent social networks, even though we didn't use that term very much before then. But in fact, we're all born with social networks. Our families are our social network, and our friends and our coworkers, the people that we play in band with are our social network. And I'm going to talk tons more about that tomorrow. So people don't want to be told what to do, but they still love to do things together, right? That's really the appeal of something like Facebook, right? People go on there and play games with their friends, or you know, they post pictures for everyone else to see, and then you have like a whole thread of comments about the picture, things like that. We're getting tons and tons out of personal interactions and using our networks online, But we don't want any one person to tell us what we're going to do or how we're going to use it. I come a lot from the advocacy background, so what we say a lot is, you know, nobody wants big nonprofit X to say, okay, everybody, today you're going to everyone press this button today, and it'll email your senator about whatever the issue is. What's a much more fulfilling experience is to give people the opportunity to talk about the issue, why it matters to them, talk to their friends about it, or hear from their friends about it. That is more work, and people may do less of that than clicking on the big button. And it's not that you're going to not have the actions still where you give people the opportunity to just press a button if that's what they want to do. But isn't it more powerful if you give people the opportunity to tell their story, right? For example, I used to work at Planned Parenthood, and we were doing a campaign to get drugstores to stock birth control pills because some of them weren't stocking them. And they invited people to upload pictures of themselves with a little sort of quote about that issue. Now, I'm a heterosexual, married, 30-something person, and I think it's really important for people to see someone like me talking about that. You know, if this isn't for a teenager or some crazy, whatever people's stereotype is of who uses birth control. So I put a picture from my wedding or a picture of me and my husband up there and said, you know, this birth control is something we rely on too. This supports our family. It nurtures our family, makes us more stable and secure by having access to birth control when we need it. And then we tell our story. And that's so much more powerful than I clicked a button and I was one of, you know, 10,000 people that emailed Elizabeth Dole that week, right? So when you think about these networks and you want people to do their own thing, you want people to talk in their own language with their friends about your stuff, maybe to pass on what you're doing or what you have to say, how do you get them to do that? One of the things that I'm very interested in is how networks move without leaders, without the sort of marching orders. So people sometimes say, we'll call it swarming. This was like a really big deal especially in the 2004 election, when certain things would happen and maybe the media didn't cover it, but blogs on the left or the right would pick it up because it fit right in with their message, and they would run with it. And then all the bloggers who read that blog would blog about it, and then it would go on and so on and so on and so on, like the shampoo commercial. It would get enormous, and it would force the media to cover things, and then they would. I try to take out all my ancient examples, but I used to talk about, for example, the letter about George Bush's military service. I don't know if y'all remember this. It was ended up being called Memogate, because it was a letter that was supposed to explain that he had done his National Guard duty or something like that. Or that he hadn't. I can't even remember, right? And it was on CBS, 60 Minutes with Dan Rather. But some bloggers looked at it and said, you know, this is in, like, Palatino font, and they didn't have that in 1974. I think this is a forgery. Now, are they going to go call CBS, like, one guy and just say, hey, I think you made a mistake? Like, is CBS going to listen to the one guy? No. Right? But a blogger who has a platform of their own and their own loudspeaker blogs about it, puts their analysis up, and then suddenly it's like wildfire. And literally 24 hours later, it was all over the internet. Then it became a story. Dan Rather lost his job over that. It wasn't even really his fault. Right? But bloggers had a huge impact with that, and nobody said, okay, everybody, this week we're going to talk about X. You couldn't have even predicted what the story was going to be. But because the network was already in place, people swarmed around that issue. So what I encourage you to think about is how to put that network in place so that people can do their own thing, talk to each other, do whatever it is they need to do. I know that's really hard because you have a specific message you're trying to tell people, and what if they come and use your network to say their own thing? And you have to figure out the right balance for those things. Sometimes it's perfectly appropriate to let people use your network to say things that are completely off message. Maybe it makes sense. In other cases, you may want to have guidelines. It depends. So what I like to talk about is what makes the network swarm. I've seen all these different words for it over the years. Lately you might hear it called Web 2.0. That just means, you know, Web 2.0 is where we talk back. You know, Web 1.0 is where we read web pages, and that was cool. That was it. But with Web 2.0, when we see a web page, we expect to interact with it, right? We want to you know, give feedback. We want to post a comment on something. Or at the very least, we're going to take it and post it to our delicious social bookmark stream so our friends can all see it. Other terms, user-generated. The Howard Dean campaign called it people-powered. You can also call it bottom-up, social marketing. I also call it grassroots organizing because I come from that activist background, and I really feel like it's really similar principles, the same things we would do to work in a community and to build connections between people and sort of build a movement together. We're just doing it online now. So all these different labels, roughly the same, mean roughly the same. Just take my time now. It is 7:05, and I can do a short version or a long version from here. It's not that long, but what do you think? How much longer is that?
What's the long version?
Not that long.
Okay.
I don't want to like give away all the stuff I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Is the thing. Because I originally thought like this was going to be like an exclusive group, and then tomorrow's a big group. But really, it's almost the same group, right?
No, tomorrow. Okay.
All right, I'll tell y'all. Then you can be the experts tomorrow. You'll be like, yeah, we know all about this. No problem. Okay. So I'm going to talk about these five aspects that make networks swarm or make them work effectively. The way I learned this, it was called network-centric advocacy because the person I learned it from based a lot of his ideas on actually military studies of network-centric warfare. The RAND Corporation has a book called Networks and Net Wars, I think it's called, which is really interesting, where they studied how activists and guerrillas, people on their side and on sides they were fighting, organized without big fat infrastructure and did very grassroots networky stuff. Okay, so and like I said, this isn't that much longer. The first aspect is all of my things are illustrated with pictures of little kids now. I didn't used to have, but now it's like yes, like in daycare. We have to share. You'll see my sharing slide later. So first, strong social ties. This is one of these elements that you want in place that allows people to connect to each other. When they read each other's stuff, they go, oh yeah, I know that. Like, I read Gavin's blog all the time, so I know he knows what he's talking about. I trust him. Or, alternately, I know him personally. He's my neighbor and I see him all the time, so I'm interested in what he has to say. Possibly both. Maybe you like someone, or maybe you trust them, or maybe both. But both of those are going to make you listen to what they say. Also, when you think about the social ties, people need to even be aware of each other. When you're thinking of like the folks that you're trying to connect to each other, like say you're trying to build your youth network, if they don't know each other, they don't even know to ask, you know, one of them plays guitar and the other one wants to do a skit at an upcoming retreat, they need to be connected to each other so they can work on it together. But if they don't know of each other, you have to make the connection for them and build the relationships. Which is called network weaving, which is a really cool new field. The second thing is common story. It doesn't mean actually telling a story or everybody reading the same book or the same script. But having, and this is probably an area where you all like knock it out of the park. But where people have common experiences or common language that they use. So, for example, at Planned Parenthood, language very important, right? Certain words that we like to use about things and certain words that we don't like to use about things. And you can make a statement that means the same thing, but if you use the wrong words, certain people are going to think, that doesn't sound like a friend. That sounds like a foe, right? And so having that common language, again, you all probably nail that. But also when you think about networks like people who live together in college, and even though it's 10 or 20, 30 years later, they still get together and they're like, remember that time when you did that silly thing, right? And everyone has a laugh. They can refer to it with like three words. And then everyone cracks up, right? It's because they have a story that they all share. They all know what that story means. So it might be, it can be shared experiences or things like that. This is all online, so you don't need to write it down. just in case you're taking notes or whatever. The third aspect is a dense communication grid, and like lots of ways to communicate with somebody. So in a street network, if one of the streets gets knocked out, if it's a cul-de-sac, if you live on a cul-de-sac and a tree goes down across your road, sorry, you can't go anywhere now, right? But if you live in a network of redundant streets, one street gets cut off, no problem. There's a million other ways to go. So I like to think about that in terms of different ways to connect to people. Like, for example, I have a lot of friends who I see on Facebook and on Twitter and sometimes in person. And each one of those will sometimes reinforce the others. And some of those relationships are stronger in one place than the other. But the fact that I see them face-to-face, or in my field of nonprofit technology, a lot, most of the people in my field don't live in Chapel Hill or even in North Carolina. But we all go to the same annual nonprofit technology conference every year. And I've known these folks for 5 or 10 years just from going to the conference together. We're like old friends. And we see each other face-to-face once or maybe twice a year at a conference. But then the rest of the year we can email each other. We read each other's tweets and stuff like that. But if I hadn't met them in the first place, I might not be as interested in what they had to say. So the face-to-face connections that you forge in one place can then be maintained online. And online connections that people make can then be solidified when they come together face-to-face later. So think of lots of every way people could connect. And you want it to be redundant, not just like these are just the Twitter people and these are the Facebook people, or these are the newsletter people and these are the web people. If you're going to touch people in as many ways as possible. Sharing, yay! Sharing is one of my favorite parts about internet culture. There's a real ethos of openness, and that sharing stuff makes it better. And it doesn't mean you can give everything away for free all the time. It's one of the things that my boss, Kathy Davidson, has been talking a lot about this week on our blog, about, because she's working to develop a policy at Duke for, you know, how to make documents open and available as possible while still protecting the authors and rewarding them for their work. And that's just a balance that's going to always be difficult. But when you share things within your network, it, again, it strengthens your network. Yeah?
Would you say that they have resolved with
Well,
because so many people were getting
And
now it's
okay
to
be
anonymous.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they've sort of found the happy medium there, right? Like, at first, the music industry was like, no, don't download, that will ruin everything, right? And it may have ruined some things for some people, but it sure didn't ruin everything, right? People are thriving. People are getting access to more music now, a wider range of music even. Because they can download it, and they have found a way to hopefully make some money off of it. So yeah, actually, that's an interesting. I hadn't thought about that as a example of that, but that's a really good example of compromise in that area. Another one of my favorites is open source software, for example, right, where people put in their time to make something together, and it doesn't have to be free. Some open source software isn't free, but by making it open, people can build onto it and make it better. So how many of you use Firefox web browser? That's open source software. You know, and when it started, everyone was like, no one's going to use that. It's made by some hippies for free. Like, that's crazy, right? Compared to IE. Everyone thought, oh, I can't trust that, you know, whatever. But actually, Firefox, you know, in a lot of ways is trusted more than Internet Explorer because there's jillions more people working on it, finding the problems and fixing them, making plugins to make it better so that if you use LinkedIn all the time, they've made you a LinkedIn plugin. If you use something I've never heard of, there's some person out there who uses it, and they've made you a plugin on Firefox to enhance your experience with it. So that's probably the best example of open source software, but there are some others. Sharing space is another great way to bring people together. If you have a space that folks can drop into, or just whatever it might be. Also, even a happy hour. But again, it's an opportunity for people to be physically together, and so that builds those kind of bonds. And of course, sharing money, like grant-making programs, can weave together networks of people or groups, certainly. The fifth thing that makes a network effective is people's relationship with the network. People have to be aware of that network and then feel like they're a member of it. This is something that I can see really applying to a church, right? Because do people feel like they're a member of what you're doing? They may know what you're doing even, but they don't think they're a part of it. So then when you come out with a communication that says the church is doing X, they go, oh, well, that thing over there. I'm not a part of that network. That's that thing over there. So, and the other thing is knowing what the network is for. I used to use the example of, like, you wouldn't go on LinkedIn looking for a date, right? It's a great social network with tons of connections, but that's not what that network is for. You could do that on Facebook, not so much, but when social networking became popular, it was used for dating much more than it is now, actually. Like on Friendster, that was like a lot of what you did with it, depending, of course, on who you were. Or on an email list. Email lists are a great way to connect people, but people who abuse the list and use it for the wrong purposes are detracting from both the list and losing their connections or alienating themselves from the group. And not building a big collective. But if someone sends an email to the group and says, hey, I found this great resource, and tons of people are interested in it, that's leading people together more. So that's it. That's my five things that make networks swarm or that function effectively. And I'm going to stop there so we can have a conversation.